This is Spectrum.
Alternative Myths, Homeopathy, Secret Society, Hypnosis, The Paranormal, Alternative Energy, UFO Abduction, The Weird, The Wild, and The Wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theophanis and Scott Jordan.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Spectrum Radio Network on BBS Radio 2. I'm Scott Jordan, and remember, there's no such thing as too much information. Our guest tonight is Foster Campbell, who is president and co-founder of Clear Compass Media, which produced Thrive. Previously, Foster was CEO of Mind Center Corporation, a pioneer in the emerging mind fitness training field, a third-degree black belt in nonviolent art of Aikido. He was also the on-screen host and script consultant for the PBS documentary on Aikido called Aikido, The Way of Harmony. Foster Gamble is a direct descendant of the late James Gamble, soap maker and founder of the U.S. Consumer Goods Corporation, Procter & Gamble. Growing up in Cincinnati, Ohio, Foster lived his childhood in a position of privilege and power, where he attended elite private schools and attended his collegiate year at Princeton University. Groomed to be a leader in the establishment, Foster chose a different path. As a young boy, Foster had an inquisitive personality that led him to envision a world scenario of universal energy source. A lifelong journey in the pursuit of knowledge, Foster involved himself in many intellectual subjects. Discontent with the current power structure in the world and the massive global suffering, Foster Gamble set to make a documentary that unveiled the true reality of our existence in the 21st century. The Thrive documentary was the result of that pursuit. Foster was also the co-founder of the California Alliance to Stop the Spray. CAS, as it's known, is an organization consisting of health professionals and individuals who share the same common goal of opposing the treatment of residential communities with pesticides. Hello, Foster. Glad to have you on the show, and welcome.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. Thrive, what a great movie. Been looking forward to that. And I watched it the day after it came out. And blew me away. The graphic work on it, the amount of subjects you covered in, I think it was 2 hours and 8 minutes. I could be close there, but the amount of subjects that you covered in that time and the depth that you went into was very interesting. So what strikes me is you personally, what events happened in your life that led you to look at the world in the way Thrive describes it?
Well, there were many, and it's interesting that your tagline is there's no such thing as too much information, because one of my concerns, one of my challenges in making this movie was putting so much information in such a short amount of time, because I didn't want to blow people away. Obviously, we want to keep people's attention and have it be that it's easy to integrate. And yet, we really needed to connect the dots of a lot of different things in order to have the impact of coherence that we were looking for. And it took me years to integrate this information emotionally and intellectually and logically and so forth. But it's been working for people all over the world. I'm thrilled to say that. And I've been asking them, you know, how come you could take it in so fast? And the beauty with which it's surrounded in the film and the honoring of the human spirit and the coherence of the information along with the solution orientation seems to be making it really viable for people to take it in and go with it in a short amount of time. Whereas when I was originally looking for this information, I would get it piece by piece without necessarily seeing a way out or how the pieces connected. So I'm thrilled to see that that's happening. So what triggered me into this work, if I look back in my past to see what were the kind of seminal incidents, the first one that I describe in the movie was when I was riding on a school bus at age 14, and I had a vision looking out the window, the light blinking through the trees, of this whirlpool vortex. And then I saw an atom in the vortex, so a kind of a nucleus at the center with the electrons going around the outside.
Yep.
And then that transformed into a solar system with the sun at the center and the planets whipping around the outside. And I thought that was kind of interesting. I was reflecting on that. And then all of a sudden I got a whole body experience of that somehow I was that same pattern, roughly halfway between in scale between a tiny atom and a vast solar system. And I became as preoccupied with figuring what that meant as Richard Dreyfuss, you know, making the mountain out of mashed potatoes. I wasn't sure what I was going for, but I knew I couldn't let up until I found out whether or not there was a fundamental energy pattern in the universe, and if so, what were the implications? So on the science side, that was really the seminal event. More on the activist side, when I graduated from college, I had been a filmmaker in college, and it was kind of assumed that I would go on and make feature films in Hollywood and so forth. But I realized that, you know, how much money and time and technology it takes to do that, and I realized that I didn't have anything important enough to say that was worth all of that. And meanwhile, as I looked around, I could see that, number one, we were at risk of nuclear holocaust. Number two, we were invading Cambodia for no apparent reason that I could find that made any sense. And number three, we were destroying the very life support system on the planet we live on. And I couldn't figure out why things were collapsing that way. So I decided to devote my life to finding out what was really behind our predicament and if there was a way out. And if I found that out, then I would make a film about it. And I thought that might take even 5 or 10 years. Little did I know, here we are 41 years later. This is finally the film that fulfills that purpose.
Wow. So there was that much time put into it. Thought put into it. But it was a process because you must have met some pretty interesting people between then and now. Obviously, not just the people you were interviewing, but the people that led you down this path of information to get to where you are.
Well, I've always been known as the question guy. I am constantly entertaining the most challenging questions I can imagine inside my own head, but I also really like to ask them of other people. And so I would piss off some teachers in school, particularly when I was studying physics, and they would talk about, well, the atom is the smallest thing, or the electron is the smallest thing. And I would say, okay, well, what's it made of? And they would kind of get upset about that. Or they would talk about the universe is 15 billion light years across. And I would say, well, that's huge, but what's it floating in? And they would say, well, you know, we can't really ask that. There's no way of knowing. So I realized that the adults in charge didn't necessarily have the answers I was looking for. Mm. So I've, you know, gone all over the world following the questions that were burning inside of me and finding whatever experts I could who could help enlighten me on different subjects. Even if I didn't agree with all or even most of what they were talking about, I've always been kind of excavating for, mining for the nuggets within each person's quest, and it's served me well.
Yeah, sounds like it. Sounds like it. Usually if a scientist says we have no way of knowing, it just means we haven't figured that out yet.
Yes.
I don't know. The saying I don't know is just, they just, well, there's no way to know that. Well, yeah, there is probably a way to know it. You just don't know it.
Yes. And the most important teacher that I ever had in school was also when I was 14, and he worked with a small group of us who had shown some talent for math and science, and we used no textbook. He would never answer a question definitively except to reflect on it and ask us questions. And the main thing I remember that he said was, any theory, any law, any belief system is at best just a model for human understanding that will always end up being replaced by one that's more useful. And I've never forgotten that, and that too has served as kind of a navigating compass for me in my quest.
Well, that leads into another question I wanted to ask. What can you tell me about the vector equilibrium? Because that was in the first part of the film, and it did lead you to a lot of different areas.
It was an absolutely fascinating shape to me. Traditionally, it's known as the cube octahedron. It's halfway between a cube and octahedron geometrically. Buckminster Fuller was the first one to call it a vector equilibrium because he recognized the importance that all of the edges, the distance between the vertices, both on the outside and from the outside into the center of the three-dimensional shape, were all the same length. And therefore, if you consider the edges to be not just lines or struts, but actually just representations of energy, which is what a vector is, if all of those are the same size, then the system is in absolute equilibrium. And it's the only shape that is in absolute equilibrium. Now, the amazing thing about that is that you will essentially never see it in nature, because the material world as we know it is a compression out of pure equilibrium into a temporary material contraction that ultimately, you know, is born and then ultimately ends up always dying back into the field or the plenum of full potential. The geometry of that field of full potential, or the geometry of the mother field, in a sense, from which all the other symmetries and geometries come, that's the vector equilibrium. Or if you take that single shape enclosure and spread it out into an infinite field, it's what he called the isotropic vector matrix. So once we understand that that's the geometry of full potential, then we can start making sense out of the way that nature contracts from full potential, which could also be called infinite consciousness, how it contracts from consciousness into matter, particularly through the 92 shapes, the logical geometric progression of shapes that we call the periodic table of atomic elements, where spirit manifests into matter through these very predictable shapes, and there's only 92 of them. I mean, there are numbers for other elements, but they're only created by explosions. They're temporary because they don't have stability. But these 92 shapes, once you understand the logical contraction out of the vector equilibrium, you can actually predict from pure logic what the number of electrons and protons will be in every shell of the periodic table. And that's one of the things that I was involved in for 2.5 years with a physicist computer programmer named Robert Gray, actually modeling in 3D computer graphics what each of those atoms would look like. In a sense, if you could fly down into the maelstrom, into the web of whirlpools that I believe each atom is, and if you could see the geometry, if you could take a snapshot of it, that's what gets revealed. So the vector equilibrium is really the mother of all of that.
Okay. Well, that definitely covers that. It sounds very, very interesting. And I'm sure there's more depth to it. Like, it's a subject you could definitely expand on. The other thing I wanted to know is, what can you tell us about the Sequoia Symposium think tank group, and who was involved? What sort of people were coming together for that?
Well, first of all, in my quest to find this fundamental energy pattern of the universe, which took decades for me, it finally boiled down for me to two fundamental patterns. One was the vector equilibrium as a geometric structure of space, an energetic structure, and the other was the torus vortex, and that's this donut-shaped whirlpool. And when it really boiled down to those two for me, I co-convened with three other people, a number of scientists and psychologists, mystics, near-death survivors, all people who were interested in what some call unification theory, trying to find a perspective from which all of the known forces and symmetry groups and so forth can be seen as part of a single whole dynamic. So we called a meeting and brought together about 35 scientists and researchers from around the world. And there were mathematicians and astronomers and physicists and so forth. Luke Kaufman, the topologist, was there. Stan Tenen, an ancient cultures and geometric researcher. Nesim Haramein, a cosmologist. Ashok Gangadin, philosopher, Saul Paul Sirag, string theorist, Many, many wonderful researchers, Lynn Claire Dennis, a near-death survivor who was shown the fundamental patterning, both the torus and the complex geometries in great detail during two near-death experiences that she went through. So The first meeting was very provocative and encouraging. So we ended up meeting several times a year for the next 3.5 years. And during the course of the first year, we saw two things. One, the scientists working at different levels, because the sciences, as we, you know, divide them into courses in schools, are really simply different scale perspectives. So if you start at the tiniest level with physics, as it gets bigger into molecules, we call it chemistry. As it goes into cells, then it's biology. As it goes into people, it's, you know, psychology and philosophy and so forth. As it goes into planets and solar systems and galaxies, you know, we call it astronomy or astrophysics. But it's really one continuum of energy that we're trying to understand. So with these various scientists, we confirmed to our own satisfaction that the vector equilibrium and the torus were, in fact, fundamental at each of those visible levels. And we came to a realization of how the torus and the vector equilibrium actually fit together and synchronize as one. And that was the holy grail that I had been looking for since high school. And so I remember we all sat around at breakfast the final morning, mm-hmm. and we said, you know, this is very exciting. You know, we found what we were looking for. Now, so what? So that's when the real fun began, which is we started breaking up into smaller groups, and one group has been writing just paradigm-busting physics papers. Another group has been working on inventing new alternative energy technologies, accessing the energy of the vacuum. And my team went off and did the modeling of the periodic table. Another group was applying these understandings for primary school education. Just an absolutely fascinating phase that continues to this day of taking this new level of understanding of how nature organizes and then applying it on all different levels of our experience to benefit humanity.
Right. Yeah. I noticed you had you did cover a lot of subjects, but our listeners are pretty familiar with the free energy subject since we've done so many shows on it. And recently, I noticed you had Adam Trombley on there as a free energy inventor. Do you have any stories with some of the free energy inventors that you met and did you see some of their inventions, and what was that like?
Oh, it's so exciting. I had the privilege to, I was involved in the field, I have been for 15 years. So as I'm sure your inventors told you, it's a field where you need to build trust to get into the real laboratories. Mm. And I've been involved in the theory. I've helped fund some of these inventors. And I've had the privilege to visit half a dozen very successful labs. And you know, it just moves you to tears when you see these technologies sitting on the bench and actually working, accessing clean, safe energy. And it just sinks into your heart that we don't need to be fighting over other people's oil. We don't need to be polluting the skies and causing asthma in our children. You know, we don't need to have the powers that be controlling people's lives through constricting the flow of energy. And so that's the great news. It already exists, and I'm confident that that in a relatively short amount of time, people will be having access to these wonderful and ultimately inexpensive ways of accessing clean energy. The other side of the story, as mm-hmm. you've probably been hearing also, is that virtually every lab I visited has been raided and shut down by FBI agents, police in full riot gear and so forth, and yep. the technology stolen, the inventors issued gag orders. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, if this stuff is real, then why don't you just, you know, have a conference and show us all the devices? Well, you know, people tried that, and this is what's happened.
Boy, did people try it. Sparky Sweet used to mail working devices to the power industry, thinking, you know, they were going to throw them a party,
yes.
and say all of our problems are solved. I mean, yes. Sparky was a brilliant man, but you know, he was sending working models to the heads of the guys who had the most to lose.
And supposedly, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,000 to 5,000 energy device patent applications have been confiscated and gag ordered. So it's not like the powers that be don't know that this stuff exists or even have the blueprints. But they so the question people in the public who are getting familiar with this for the first time, I recommend should ask themselves is, if these are all hoaxers and charlatans, and if the second law of thermodynamics as we know it would prohibit this type of device, then why are all these inventors getting shut down?
Because the
second law of thermodynamics applies to closed systems. And the torus, by definition, is an open system, just like every atom in your body, just like the sun, just like a galaxy. It's an open system connected with a boundless energy of an infinite universe. So we're really coming into a whole new level of physics understanding, and the benefits are going to be just beyond our imagination.
You know what? I hope that this is – there's a couple of things that are happening now that give me hope. I remember Bedini was on a radio show about 15 years ago, Open Minds Radio, I think it was, and he was the host, and him had done a bunch of shows together, and they were saying, you know what, it's just around the corner. There's nothing that the powers can do. We have the machine. We can bring it out. And you were thinking, wow, next year I'm going to have a machine in my basement to run my house. And it's just the thumb has been pressing down so hard for so long that it's difficult to get beyond that. But on the other hand, there are some signals or there's some information out there that's coming out more and more. And I would say that one of them would be the Occupy movement that's in over 4,500 cities worldwide right now.
Exactly. I was just going to mention that same thing, Scott, because the Occupy movement isn't only about how people are getting screwed financially. It's about freedom and justice on all levels. So as people are waking up and realizing how many different areas are being suppressed, there is the largest social movement in human history that is not going to go away. It's getting very electronically connected and organized around really viable principles. And one of the issues that they want to take on is stopping the suppression of access to this type of energy.
I know, because I've talked to Occupy people, and I know that Thrive is being shown in media rooms all around the country.
Yes.
They're showing Thrive in the media tents, and you might not know this, or maybe you do know this, but they're also projecting it on the side of walls.
I haven't heard that. Tell me a little more about that.
They're projecting it on the side of a building. I heard that they were doing it with your film and with Ben Stewart's Ungrip, which talks about sovereignty.
Yes.
And Earthships.
Wow, gives me goosebumps. I'm glad you told me that.
Yeah, projecting, you know, you have the projectors you can put on the top of cars, and it projects it on the side of a building. Then they have the audio coming through the car speakers. It's pretty impressive, really.
Yeah, it's a great symbol of what's coming. You know, just
And I think it's a continuing thing. I don't think that the Occupy movement is a new thing. I just think new in flavor, old in inspiration, because if we would have had the internet in the 60s, this would be all over.
That's right. And I think one of the main things now is to keep the internet open. There, you know, the government's trying to take control, the corporations are trying to take control, the UN's got to take control, and that's where groups like Anonymous also are springing up to protect access to being in communication with each other with the truth rather than just corporate propaganda.
I agree completely. If we were to have finally be able to implement zero-point energy, there's many names for it, free energy, zero-point energy, inventions like Trombley's homopolar generator, how would we even begin to reshape our cities and communities? we're dying of corporate asphyxiation as it is.
Yeah. Well, it's so exciting to imagine, and I've been doing some work with economic experts like Catherine Austin Fitz and Bill Still and Hazel Henderson and some others, and we've been doing some calculations on what an individual's life or a family's life would be like if free energy were released and we had an honest money system, just even those two things. And imagine now you're not having to pay to fill up your car. You're not having to pay to heat your house or to run the appliances in your house. And you're not having to pay interest to the Federal Reserve for making up money out of nothing. You're not having to pay for foreign wars of aggression, and on and on. And their estimates are that for the average individual and family, that you would have, working the same or probably considerably less, between 3 and 10 times the amount of income and assets that you have now, just from releasing free energy and having an honest money system. So I invite listeners to imagine what you would start doing with more time and, let's say, 6 or 7 times as much money flow and assets as you have already. So now people are owning their house and their cars, and they're choosing what kind of schools they want their kids to go to, and they're investing in great projects in their local communities and actually having free time to enjoy their families and friends and to create, you know, their own projects, to realize their own kind of dream missions in life. So that's why I spent some time in the film laying out just the seeds of some visions of what life could be like in a truly free world based on integrity. And the releasing of the free energy is a key element, and it's the one that of all the responses, and we're just getting thousands of responses from all over the world of appreciation and enthusiasm for the what Thrive is opening up for people in their awareness. But the single most commonly responded to item is this whole area of free energy. People are saying, you know, where can I show up to protest against the suppression? Where can I contribute or invest to helping these inventors and creating the legal defense funds and the security and the demonstrations to bring this stuff out? So the time is definitely coming. The exoskeleton of the old system is dropping away.
Yeah, I think it's the one thing that would create an immediate impact on people's lives.
When you think how fast cell phones have spread worldwide,
yeah.
Imagine if you had a device like that that ran your car and your house and your business and so forth. Imagine how dramatically that would, as Stephen Greer says in the movie, it would rearrange the power structure, pun intended, on the planet more than anything else in human history.
Yeah, I agree, which is why people can understand the amount of suppression that can be poured into this. You know,
yeah.
The inventors don't even get on the radar until they're at a certain stage. And if they're trying to use the patent process, forget it. That's like putting a target on your forehead. Applying for a patent is just telling them what you're doing.
Yes, exactly. And one of the most exciting things about my research into the bad news was that with all the huge problems that we've got, the corruption and pollution and war and all this kind of stuff, the deeper you follow the money, the more you realize virtually every one of these problems is human-made and actually created by a very small group of people and usually intentionally. So as those people get exposed, human-made problems can be corrected by human beings if they're caught in time, and that's starting to happen now. And each one of the power structures that the powers that be are using to impose this kind of control and dumbing down and sickness on people, every single one of them is dependent on our participation for its survival. Now, the strength of a pyramid is in its base, and as the 99% is waking up, and starting to withdraw their financial support to take the money out of what Catherine Austin Fitz calls the tapeworm banks, and to not support the corporations that are doing the clear-cutting and the coal-fired power plants and the banks that are funding this type of thing. And as people are starting to refuse to go into these wars of aggression, those systems are crumbling and will continue more and more as people are waking up. And there's the movement worldwide is so decentralized and leaderless that it is now, in my opinion, absolutely unstoppable.
Yeah, that's the thing. There are no leaders.
Right.
Really, there aren't. I mean, we're all balls of light. I mean, if you've done some research and near that experience, you know what that's, you know, all about. I mean, there's no distinction, really. There's no distinction between one 40-watt bulb and the other 40-watt bulb.
Right.
You know, you're a ball of light, I'm a ball of light. But in the in like the physical realm that we have to deal with, the only way to, and this is a question, the only way to align with nature's natural abundance is to take out the toxic conditions. Corporate power, greed, military, police, political and financial oppression. People are awakening, but how do you view having to fully awaken the vast majority without having a global revolution on our hands?
Well, it's a really powerful question, because I think this is where revolution meets evolution. And I'm really pleased so far with most of what I see with Occupy, because rather than selling out to the old dichotomies between left and right and, you know, labor and management, all those old boxes, they're really looking in their evening conversations for what is the system that would actually honor each individual. And they're doing a great job so far of looking for solutions that are based on nonviolence, nonviolation, because it's absolutely critical. The last bastion of the powers that be, given the money and the military force that they have, is to instigate a violent revolution and give themselves the excuse to use their weaponry to create a global police state crackdown and start putting people in FEMA camps and, you know, arresting and assassinating dissidents and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
Whereas if it's done nonviolently, like King did, like Gandhi did, by withdrawing participation from the system, then the system will come down. And I'm not naive about this. I know even in the protests, you look and you see what's happening with people being killed and injured in the Middle East right now in the protests. I don't think that the transition will be pretty. But the degree to which we can hold to nonviolence and just be organized in withdrawing our participation, the more the powers that be are going to have to scramble to find a way to blend in with the new systems that are emerging. I saw an interview on CNN that was inspiring to me in the early days of Occupy Wall Street. They interviewed the police commissioner, Kelly, and they asked him, you know, how are you going to keep control over this thing? And he kind of rolled his eyes and he said, well, you know, I'm not actually sure. He said, the usual protocol is we bring in the lead, we identify the leaders, we bring them in, we tell them the regulations, and if they promise to obey the regulations, we give them a permit. And he says, you know, we haven't been able to find the leaders, and they don't seem to be particularly interested in our regulations and our permits. Now, obviously, there are public and private property problems that go on with the actual occupation of physical space, but that's just the vanguard that's gotten people's attention. You know, this whole Occupy movement, I really believe, is transforming now into, you know, a very similar notion that we have with the Thrive movement, of that it lives in people's consciousness and takes form in all these different issues as what empowers people based on integrity and true freedom. Mm. And so as people are needing to leave their tents or leave parks and so forth, that's not the end of the movement. That's just the beginning of an organization which is growing behind the scenes as people connect electronically connect philosophically, and then begin to take nonviolent action to actually create new paradigm systems. So it's going to be very exciting to watch. It's the riskiest period in human history, given the technology and the weapons that are available now. It's also the most exciting time to be alive that I can imagine.
Yeah, I agree. They have a thing in the Occupy where if they get moved out of a park or they get moved out of their area, they have a saying, remove, regroup, reoccupy.
Yes.
So you just peacefully pull back, you regroup, and you peacefully go back in again. And there's really not a lot you can that the authorities can do with that other than remove them again, and they're just going to keep coming back. This is a wave. There's multiple waves crashing on the shore right now, and it started a long time ago in human history.
Yes, well, a lot of my background was in martial arts. I studied karate and tai chi, and then finally ended up in training and teaching the nonviolent martial art of Aikido for 15 years. And so I really got to feel the power of not trying to be rigid in one's position. Because in Aikido, you're taught to keep your center, but then be humble enough to move it out of an attacking force. Because that way you're like water. You know, you can go around barriers, and there's no place to attack, in a sense, because you're not a rigid defense system. You're actually blending with the forces as they are. And I see Occupy being more Aikido-like and finding that universal power from actually being soft but relentless in a way that's really encouraging to me.
Be like water, my friend.
Yes.
Great interview quote from Bruce Lee. Can you elaborate more on the geometrical symbols and the fact that they are spread throughout the centuries and all through the world? Now, we're going back in history. You see these symbols in old temples, in temple floors and temple walls, in ancient artifacts, in what Michael, from our previous guests, Michael Cremo and Klaus Dana, talk about old parts, which is out-of-place artifacts. They contain these sorts of symbols that you're talking about, these geometrical symbols and images.
Well, it's a fascinating area to me because as I, after decades of quest, came down to the vector equilibrium in the torus as the most fundamental energetic shapes from which our reality is constructed, I also met people like Nassim Haramein and Stan Tenen, and I've read the works of Graham Hancock and people like that who've done fantastic research into ancient cultures and revealed the fact that in virtually every, these millennial-old cultures, these same shapes are very specifically encoded in their buildings and their stories and their icons, oftentimes to, five and six levels of error correction from the point of view of the science of coding. So it raises the point, how did they know about what we're just finding at the leading edge of physics right now? How did they know about that thousands of years ago?
Well, ancient cultures write about that, and they tell you how they know. Go ahead.
So I think it's a combination of two things, as best I can understand. One is that I think that all cultures have had people who were, shaman and high priests and near-death survivors and so forth, initiates who were capable of tuning their own consciousness to unusual vibrational frequencies where they could access cosmic consciousness, what's oftentimes called the Akashic Records, or different names, and the Oracle. Different cultures have different names for it, but it's accessing information that's actually in the field of consciousness. And when you have some expertise and know the questions to ask, then oftentimes you can get access to information that's not just available to the rational mind or necessarily in history books. So I think part of it has come through that. But then there's another whole aspect, which is, I think the evidence is just overwhelming, that we have been visited on this planet throughout the millennia by more advanced beings from off planet or from other vibrational realms who have visited and shared information, shared stories, shared technologies with various races and cultures, and that those have then been encoded and passed on. And now I think is the time when we're at a place where we can understand some of it scientifically, and we're also at a place where we need to reawaken the intuition and where we need to understand most fundamentally how does energy work in the universe so that we can design our systems around blending with it rather than exploding it, because at our current state of technological development, the very life on Earth, on planet Earth as we know it, is at risk if we don't learn that harmonious way. So I think for both of those reasons, the discoveries are just happening all over the world now, linking ancient cultures, advanced cultures, and our own discoveries.
Right, right, exactly. And, you know, how did the Sumerians know about all the planets, you know?
Right.
Counting from out in.
Really, and, knowing, and the Dothan and all that's built into the pyramid of the Giza Plateau, is just, it doesn't make sense by normal historical criteria.
No, it doesn't. And some of the ancient artifacts that have been found, example being the Bosnian pyramid that they've been working on for a couple of years now. An amazing amount of architecture is going into that. They've done some sound readings on it, and they've gotten they found the main tunnels, and they filled them with a concrete, like an aggregate that's harder than the surrounding stone. So what was so important that thousands of years ago, that 6,000 years ago, that they had to fill it back in again? That if they're dating it correctly, they've got teams out there, and it's over, you know, 12,000 years old. But if they're dating it correctly, that means that it was open and available for 7,000 years. But what happened to make them fill all of the passages in that pyramid with the concrete, an aggregate concrete harder than the stone that surrounds it? What was so important that they needed to protect?
Yes. And, you know, I mentioned briefly in the movie and more on the website that, in my opinion, after a lifetime of research, I believe that the single most important message that we're being sent from the past and from the future in the sense of advanced cultures, and the most important thing that we can discover, is how energy works, number one. And number two, once we discover how energy works, how can we align with energy? Because if we don't, we destroy ourselves and our surroundings. And if we do, then that I believe that learning to align with the natural flow of energy is the art, it's the science, and it's the celebration of love. And that's what we're here for. And I believe that advanced cultures are almost babysitting us, watching us to try to make sure we don't destroy the planet and don't take things like nuclear waste off the planet so that we can have the opportunity to not only be a sustainable culture, but to join an interplanetary, intergalactic culture at the next level of harmony with life energy.
Yeah, I've said that on the show as well. I've said, you know, for me, the question of UFOs is, it's been over for a long time.
Yeah.
It's when you first get into it, you go, geez, I wonder if UFOs are real. I'm way beyond that, you know. Yeah. They're real. Suck it up. And now the thing is, why are they trying to repress all that? Well, if you think about the energy systems within those craft, that would be another threat to the society, because if some of them had crashed, or if there had been some sort of deals made in history where alien tech was involved. Now you or me, being, you know, just average guys meeting, being polite to each other and having a conversation and willing to share things with each other, would just give it out, right?
Yes.
But we don't have anything to lose, right? So the power structures, they have something to lose. And if it's seen as a top-down system, and there's control involved, they have the loss of control is almost worse than the thought of the loss of the economic gain.
I think that's a really important point. I'm glad you made that. A lot of people are just waking up to, and it was an important realization when I came across it, that people talk about Wall Street greed and, you know, follow the money and so forth. And it's important to understand money as a means, but particularly the international banking cartel, which can essentially print money whenever they want, it's not about money for them after a certain point. It's about controlling other people's lives and making sure that they can protect their influence, protect what they have. And if they're operating from a worldview of scarcity and fear, they will go to any ends to protect that, including great violence, as is obvious. So it's vital that people understand that this is not just about money. It's about obsoleting the control of people who are obsessed with controlling others, so that we move into a civilization where everyone has control over their own lives, as long as they don't violate another person's freedom of control over their life.
Yeah, and that's like a sovereignty. That's like a sovereignty statement.
Exactly.
A sovereign lives his life by, you know, you don't interfere with me without my permission, and I won't interfere with you without your permission. And a lot of what the political and controlling corporate structures are doing is they're interfering with us without our consent. And the only people sort of that get a vote democratically, you know, democracy is two wolves and a sheep voting on what's for dinner.
Right.
Right. So,
and they also say, in addition to that, that liberty is a well-armed sheep dissenting the vote.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, when we have these sorts of power structures, see, that has to, my interest in this is learning what will make that fall away. What is going to have that so that we just get the water sloshing around in the pail now, but it's not over the edge, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's got to get over the edge of the pail. So what will make that structure fall away? You know, I thought earlier that you see the signs in the Occupy movement say, end the Fed, and things like that. If they had signs that said free energy now, then that might, you know, push it over the edge.
Yeah, I think that will be coming. And on our website, we've got places where people can sign up for what we call critical mass actions, and like what Occupy is doing. And several of the critical mass actions have to do with free energy. So that'll be one of the target areas for a lot of people. But I think that the question you ask is, I don't know of any more important one, about how do we move toward sovereignty? Because if the Taurus is the fundamental pattern of sustainability, then nature is showing us at every level, if we just know how to look, a blueprint for creating sustainable systems. And it turns out that if you understand that, you can build technologies which can access energy sustainably. In Aikido, if you recognize the sanctity of your own toroidal field and honor that of others, and so that you don't enter theirs without being safe, and then only neutralize violence without having to injure people. The Taurus is a key to sustainability at every level because it represents wholeness. So when we look at the human level, I think one of the key questions is, where does the Taurus show up at the human level? And it's not the group. The group is an aggregate concept which is useful for certain things, but it's not real in the sense that an individual is actually identifiable, whereas the notion of a group is an abstract concept. So that I believe that it's critical that we understand that the fundamental unit or quantum of wholeness at the human level is each individual human being. So then the question is, how do we create systems that honor that individual wholeness? Because if the key navigating insight, as I suggest in the movie, is non-violation, then you turn right around and start designing a culture, and the first thing everybody assumes is, okay, well, we have to have a government. And in order to have a government, you have to have taxation. And people just assume that involuntary taxation, in other words, somebody putting a uniform on and coming and taking your money, whether you like it or not, is somehow the basis of a just system. It's never worked throughout history. The involuntarily funded state has proven itself to be the most destructive force in human history, causing over 200 million deaths in the 20th century alone, and the majority of those within the state, not just in foreign wars. So we're barking up the wrong tree. So then the question that I think we need to be entertaining is, what would it look like to actually start self-organizing in our economy as a true free market of voluntary exchange, rather than a state intervention, coercive system with a monopoly on money and monopoly backed up by a monopoly on force. If you actually had a true free market in currency and you had private competing justice systems who had to prove themselves to have a good reputation for deciding things fairly and based on human freedom rather than what politicians or corporations they're getting paid off for. These are just a few seed ideas that have been developed to a great extent by a lot of great thinkers like Mises and Rothbard and Hoppe and Boas and Stéphane Molyneux has the most popular philosophy blog on the internet right now, where he's just gone a long way in actually showing how these systems not only can work, but look like they may be the only basis on which we can create designable systems. So I agree with you that sovereignty is really a key kind of true north for our navigation right now.
Yeah, it's interesting. And what I like about Thrive is it makes people think about those things. It gives them, it snaps them awake long enough for them to dream, to have daydreams about what it would look like. And what you say in the film is, what would it look like? And that's a very important statement. And I don't know if people understand how important that statement is, because you have to be able to imagine first, what would it look like if? What would it be like if? And I lost my thought.
You know, that portion of the film where I created that vision was triggered by an experience we had right at the beginning of filming Thrive, where we were at a conference, an environmental conference with college students from all over California and a number of wonderful pioneers from around the world. And in addition to interviewing some of the pioneers like Satish Kumar and Elizabeth Satouris and Vandana Shiva, we interviewed 20 of the college students. Now, these were bright, educated students who were already committed to environmental activism. And we interviewed 20 of them, and one of the questions that I asked all of them is, what is your vision for what life could be like on planet Earth? If you pictured actually working out, what could it be like? And out of the 20, only two of them were able to come up with a positive vision. And I was stunned and just so saddened by the degree to which the visionary capacity was being squashed by the culture that we're in. So we really wanted to begin presenting some grounded, viable visions in Thrive and on our website. And there's one other thing I want to say about that, which is really important, because some people think, oh, well, that's just a utopian vision. You're counting on everybody being enlightened and getting along. And I would say it's exactly the opposite of that. We are envisioning an evolved planet, but not based on just hoping everybody would learn to get along or suddenly everybody was being enlightened. We're not going to be in a harmonious society tomorrow, but if we're going to be at some point, we're going to need to go through transition stages. And that's why we lay out on a glimpse in the animation and in the film, but then in much more depth in all of the different sectors on the website, of what would these three stages that we propose look like. Because the first stage cuts the military budget in half, gets rid of the Federal Reserve and the interest that we're now paying on these fictitious loans, and instantly over $1 trillion a year is freed up without any new violations to fund the transition. So the transition to organic farming and the transition to healthcare for people who have been most damaged by the system, who ultimately will be prosperous enough to afford their own health care. But right now, just like an injured part of your body, there are a lot of people who need help in a transition. But the key is not to create any new violations, no new taxations involuntarily while we're doing this transition. So stage one is about moving back toward integrity in all our systems without creating any new violations and taking care of those most in need. Meanwhile, we're moving towards stage two, which is the shrinking of government. It starts right away, but it will become more obvious as we enter into the second stage, that the only real viable purpose for a government is the protection of individual rights and the commons that we share, like the air that we breathe, the water, the frequency bands that we need to communicate. And so as we gain the prosperity from stage one and stage two, I believe that the systems will come into place with a truly voluntary market of free exchange and these what are called dispute resolution organizations, which can resolve conflict, you know, based on individual sovereignty and based on real insurance and real private protection and so forth that will be affordable to everyone. Then we can begin to experience the systems that are not based on the state or not based on the power of a few that the rest of us don't have, that will actually, I think, end up leading toward an ultimately truly voluntary civilization. And my guess is if you could travel to one of these other planets where beings are far enough advanced that they could be warping space and time and coming to visit us, I think that you'll find one of the absolute cornerstones of a sustainable civilization is going to be the sovereignty of the individual.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that about asking that question, because I've been running an ongoing experiment for 2 years now. When I meet people, after I get to know them a little bit, I'll ask them, what would you do if money didn't exist? And the number one answer was very surprising to me. The number one answer was, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
They don't know. And some of them would be like, what do you mean no money? How I work hard. I need to get paid for what I do. And this whole, they go through this, but I'm attached to this concept of money and it makes me who I am and I work and I get stuff and, you know, I get this imaginary thing handed to me so I can buy real things. They're very connected with that. In that case, what I do is say to them, okay, that's okay. Money exists, but let's say you had $1 billion. What would you do? And then they have to think and go, well, and some of them say, I would write. I would spend more time with my family. I would travel more. I would integrate with people who have the same interests I do in the hobbies that I do when I'm not working, when I can find time to do it.
Yeah.
These are the sort of answers that will come up. But the number one answer was, I don't know.
Yes. Well, that's, in a sense, what happened for me, you know, because as I graduated from college, as I was describing before, I also found out that I was inheriting some money from my grandparents. It was kind of like winning the lottery. Not a huge amount, but enough that I could have the very unusual opportunity to decide what I wanted to do with my life that would really have meaning for me rather than just go around complaining about my job.
Right.
And so I've had the privilege, most of all, of being able to ask the questions that were compelling for me and spend the time answering those questions. And that's one of the reasons for Thrive, was that I wanted to save people the time that I had to spend decades putting these pieces together so that people can actually get those pieces in a couple of hours in the movie. And, you know, I mean, you can spend months on the website and it will continue to grow.
I agree.
The purpose is to provide the information, provide the tools through which people can free themselves up and not only take action that doesn't take a lot of time or money, because these days most people have very little of either to spare, But we can start moving toward a society where people do have the resources of time and money and just the ability to nurture their own visions and those of others to create a world where everybody actually can thrive. I know in my heart that that is possible, and now it's up to humanity to figure out how to do that. And as we say in the last line of the theme song of Thrive, we all have what it takes to thrive. I've become convinced of that, and I'm actually more optimistic, even given how much I know of the problem. I'm more optimistic than I've ever been in my life about this.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that that I say, is that the truth will set you free, but first it'll piss you off.
Yes.
Because when you do sort of come out of your groggy sleep and realize that there is no distinction between the right and the left, that these are puppets being held up for you to take a choice, choose this one, choose that, divide people into, you know, going after this political party or that political party that separates people. Right. You know, you got entertainment like football. I have my team, you have your team, we're separate.
Yeah.
There's all of these things out there that are designed almost like chess moves to separate us.
Yes.
And have us not agree or debate about, or, you know, find some sort of disconnect with the other person, and not enough things for us to find equilibrium.
Yes.
You know, so maybe part of what you're going to be doing or working towards is bringing that together, bringing the other systems together in equilibrium.
Well, one of the things that we've really set out to do is to help empower a self-creating global movement. Because neither Kimberly nor I have the slightest interest in trying to organize, manage, or run some sort of global organization. It wouldn't work. We don't want to do it. It's not the way nature thrives. But what we have set out to do is empower people with the information in the movie and inspire them to take action, and then on the website to give them a lot of tools, tools for organization, tools for research, tools for taking action with a laser-like kind of precision that we've discovered over years of activism in our own lives, so that then people can create in their own communities, their own groups, and choose what level do they want to work on. Is it meeting immediate needs or working on systemic change or actually devoting themselves to the shift in consciousness from which all of that comes? People are called to different levels. And then what sector is it? Is your passion and expertise in education, or is it in media or economics or governance? Are you an artist? We've got it all organized so that you can find the area where you feel like, wow, I want to get active, and this is exactly what I would be passionate about doing. And then you'll know that the other sectors are being handled by people who are passionate about and good at doing those things. And then, because it's going to take a ton of people worldwide to turn this thing around, but that's exactly what we've got. We've got the largest social movement in human history, as Paul Hawken points out, that doesn't need a leader. We have absolute confidence in the creativity and strength of the human spirit when it's well-informed and has the freedom to act and to organize with others. And, boy, it's happening even faster than we imagined.
Right, I agree. Now, will there be a Thrive lecture tour featuring some of the people you interviewed? That way the majority of people, the 99%, can ask questions and learn from those people during a lecture tour. Is it something that you've got in the background going
on? Well, it's interesting that you ask, because we're in the middle of planning that right now. I can't commit to it yet because it's not all nailed down, but the current idea is probably in March, April, and May. We will be traveling on the West Coast in March, in the Midwest in April, and on the East Coast in May. And
in June, he'll be in Canada.
Well, yeah, actually, that's true. We plan on going outside the country in June and July, and then taking some time off in August. And then we've also had a lot of invitations from all over the world for not only early summer, but next fall as well to do tours in Australia and the Netherlands and France and England and so forth. And what we're looking to do, you know, obviously we've released the film to rent on the internet as well as to buy DVDs for those who want to own it. But we're also planning on doing a theatrical tour, kind of thrive on the big screen, and going city to city where people will already to a great extent know about Thrive, but will want to get together with their community. They'll want to have a true cinematic experience with a big screen and great sound, which the film was designed for. And also, Kimberly and I will be going on this tour and then having different ones of the pioneers join us in each city so that we can have not only an experience of the film, but community meetings where we can get together and find out what people are wondering and, you know, what else we can share and learn from them and really have a community Thrive experience in each one of these cities that we'll be visiting, and as well go to do presentations and Q&A sessions in local colleges and universities as well.
Well, that'll be great because that'll be a little bit like a Sequoia symposium for the public.
Yes. You know, exactly.
If some of the people that you interviewed come with you, then you may have people, when they're done watching the film, going, you know what, that one guy that says, I got to ask him a question. And if that may lead to more questions. So, I mean, it's a good idea, I think.
Yeah, thanks. And that's somewhat, to some degree, what the website is, too, because when we came up with this concept for the film, for those who of your listeners who haven't seen it yet, we have a toroidal-shaped high-tech magic carpet that we use as a special effects motif to tie everything together. And we get to fly around through time and space and visit with different pioneers and go down into the atom and out into galaxies and so forth. And, you know, as we were making this film, everybody who was helping us said, boy, you know, I want one of those. And so we really designed the website to be your own individual navigator module. And the visuals are designed as if it were. And then you get to actually have your own sector navigator and just, you know, go into not only the different sectors, into the information, but also visit with various pioneers. There's over 200 video clips that didn't make it into the film.
Yeah.
That are already available on the web, and there will be more and more of those coming out. We actually had 400 hours of just incredible footage of these remarkable explorers. And so you can go and have your own interactions with them there. And then also in our resource tree, you can find out how to access them on their websites and, you know, find their books, find their DVDs and that type of thing. So we're really looking to be a hub to connect people for their own explorations, not to try to, you know, limit or manage people's explorations in any way.
Yeah, just you're going to be like just a lounge where people could go and get with a lounge or a library.
Right, a lounge moving at light speed.
Right, exactly. I agree completely. Yeah, I mean, that's going to be interesting. If you do travel around and some of the people that you interviewed go with you, that would be great because they can be asked in-depth questions. And then that way, if they have more time, then they can get deeper into what they're talking about. And it also, people are very tactile.
Yeah.
There's one thing about seeing a video or reading a website, and it's a completely different experience when you're physically there. If you're physically there, physically involved, it makes a tactile impression of that experience on you. And you can take it farther. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about.
I do, and I totally agree. That's one of the reasons why we're doing this, is we want to – I mean, this virtual world is fantastic. It's made this film and website possible. It's just an amazing tool. And at the same time, it doesn't replace human beings being in the same room having a spontaneously creative conversation. And I know I learned best from hearing people be in dialogue and being able to ask my own questions. And we want to provide that for people as much as we can.
Yeah, I agree. That would be great. Let me know when you come to Canada or Toronto area, and we'll get you hooked up.
Definitely.
We'll get a place locally in Toronto where you can go and give a speech and gather a whole bunch of people. That's no problem. We used to do my co-host and me used to do that all the time. Set up, you know, lectures and stuff. So
yes. Back, do you back, know about this guy, Stefan Molyneux?
Stefan Molyneux, I do now.
He's Canadian also, and check out his website is freedomainradio.com, and I think he's one of the leading thinkers on the planet right now, and he's not only brilliant, but he's funny, and he's very open-minded, and really talks a lot about the value of what he's learning in his relationship with his wife and his children, and I think he's one of your kind of premier Canadian thought leaders right now. So I want to introduce you to him.
I will definitely check that out. I will definitely check that out. Now, Thrive did talk about the medical industry. You talked about organic farming. You talked about GMO foods. Maybe in this... if we do have a new evolution of humanity, there won't be any place left for the people like Monsanto, or the big pharma will become little pharma. And we've done shows where we've talked about the vaccination program and how, you know, dangerous we felt that was in our research and in our opinion, that we're being injected with stuff that is not natural to the body, it's foreign to the body, and not healthy. So maybe areas like that will just fall away, no longer necessary.
Well, for me, it always goes back to wholeness. And we've talked a little bit about the Torah, we've talked about sovereignty and so forth. And what I've tried to do with Thrive and the website is give people two new lenses, potentially for some people, to look through at the different aspects of their lives. And one of the lenses is what we call the global domination agenda, where you follow the money and find out who's in charge, what they're actually up to, and that gives you a basis to actually create solutions which are commensurate to the problem. The other lens is the Torah, which is the basis of wholeness, which therefore is the compass for designing our systems. So if we look through those two lenses at things like food and health, let's just take food, first of all. If you go into the usual grocery store, much less, you know, a 7-Eleven or a Quick Stop or something like that, it's challenging to even find foods you recognize. You may recognize the packaging, but to actually recognize what the food looked like when it was growing in nature is a challenge because it's so processed, and it's full of high fructose corn syrup, and it's full of MSG, and it's full of aspartame, and all of these chemicals, which along with the fluoride in the water and the squalene and the vaccines and so forth, are truly poisoning. It's causing heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's. And so if we look through this lens, there's obviously not a nurturing of wholeness that's going on through the processed food and the GMO farming and the injection of artificial cells into whole seeds and that type of thing. So if we take the opposite of that and look and see, okay, what would food look like through wholeness? You look at whole foods or whole grains, whole seeds. So you have organic farming where the seeds are what's been developed over millions of years to nurture the health of the beings that eat it and the plants that grow from it. And you look at a whole system ecology where it's grown. And so instead of having the monoculture where you have one plant for as far as the eye can see you take out all the other plants, and then you fill the soil with herbicides, pesticides, fertilizers, all oil-based. And then you're constantly fighting off, so-called pests, which are simply the insects that used to live in that environment and are no longer kept in balance by the natural balance of plants and birds and so forth, animals that used to be there. If instead we go back to organic polyculture farming, where plants are intermingled and the natural predators can circulate, it's been proven again and again that you get more yield in the long run for less cost and much healthier food. And then let's look at health for a minute. Almost everywhere you go, it's like running a gauntlet between the radiation from smart meters and from the airport scanners and from irradiation of food and now
Fukushima.
Yeah, exactly. Nuclear disasters and nuclear waste dumps and so forth. And then you look at what's being put in the water with the fluoride, which, as you probably know, most people started as a tranquilizer in concentration camps, and then look at the GMO foods, which have been proven now in animal tests to cause disease and infertility in second and third generations, and the infertility that's being caused by the squalene and other toxins in the vaccines. And the deeper you look into this, the more obvious it is that this is not all just coincidence or even greed on the part of the corporations. You couldn't, the odds would not allow you to predict this kind of consistent behavior other than with an intentional agenda. And sure enough, you follow the money back, and it's the same international banking cartels which were responsible for not only funding both sides of most recent wars, but also have been intentionally involved in eugenics and depopulation.
Yeah.
So it's a harsh realization to come across, but if someone's out to injure you or to dumb you down or even kill you, it's better to know it so that we can respond and ideally respond nonviolently. It's an economic war that is being waged against us, and we can actually respond economically by voting with what we choose to participate in and not, who we choose to vote for and not. Because if you look at health through the lens of the Taurus, what is a full, vibrant, healthy Taurus as a human being? Because the electromagnetic field that surrounds our body is a vibrant Taurus when it's healthy, as is every cell, every molecule, and every atom in your body. Then that's based on eating whole foods, and it's based on exercising enough and sleeping enough and keeping your stress in balance, because health, like spirituality, in my experience, is a natural outcome of being aware enough to keep your life in balance and follow your own inner guidance. And that's not what people who want to control our lives want you to know. So people are now waking up to both what is being inflicted on us and saying no, not only avoiding products, but beginning to prosecute the individuals and the corporations that are promoting this stuff, but also choosing non-GMO farming, choosing non-irradiated and whole foods, choosing not to be vaccinated with artificial toxins. And what we're beginning to discover is the natural radiance that can keep your immune system free of cancer, free of heart disease and so forth, just through learning how to live as a whole human being. I think it's our birthright to know when we're being healthy and not. But we actually have to figure out how to be healthy and not. And it's quite a challenge these days. But I think as I look around, people are waking up.
Yeah, it's just we got to get away from the take two pills and don't call me in the morning. here's a prescription for a year. Here's a Band-Aid for the rest of your life that you'll be paying me for. These sorts of things are not, these are not cures. These are Band-Aids. That's all they are. You cannot make money from a cancer cure. You make money from cancer treatment.
Yes.
You can't make money from a disease cure. And anybody who comes up with one, how quickly they disappear.
Yes.
And this has been the same story in the field of medicine and alternative health as it has been in free energy. I don't see any distinction between the two when it comes to the people who have made groundbreaking discoveries and they suddenly die of a massive, fast-acting heart attack.
Yes. And you know, we've talked about a number of areas, and it's really fun to talk to another comprehensivist like yourself. And you know, we've talked about governance, we've talked about economics, we've talked about energy and so forth, and now the health and food. Another area that I'd like to mention is the whole area of information, and Okay. Specifically having to do with media and education. Because if there are people who want to control other people's lives, as I go into in the movie, they would need to not only control money, but they would need to gain control over your access to information. They'd need to shape your thinking so that you're not thinking critically and you don't rebel against a system of control. And it seems like the two easiest ways to do that are through the media and through the educational system. And so I really encourage people. Now, it's going to be easier with this group than most, because if you're listening to this, you're already listening to Scott's show. And so you're accessing independent media that is really searching for the truth and not limited by allegiance to particular corporate sponsors or governmental regulation. But I encourage people to do that in every aspect of your relationship to media. You know, if you're watching the corporate media for news or something like that, at least look through the lens of the global domination agenda and ask yourself, who's funding them? What are their motivations? And what are they not telling you? Why are they focused on Lindsay Lohan when the banksters are running off with, you know, $17 trillion of your grandchildren's money? What is going on there? So use that as a lesson of how to access media, and fill your computer's dashboard with access to things like this program and others. There are lots of channels now. There are lots of people who collect videos and who have news feeds and so forth that you can actually count on to search out the truth rather than just relying on the corporate and government propaganda machines that have shaped so much of the dumbing down of this country and around the world. And then also I want to mention just briefly education, because if you're going to get people to go along with a system where we will be dominated by a small cartel without speaking up, which is obviously beginning to end now as people are waking up and speaking up and taking to the streets and the internet, they've got to capture people at a very young age and start teaching their own perspective on history, on governance, on philosophy and so forth at a young age. And to a great extent, our public school system, and even to a large extent our private school system, has been taken over by the banking, corporate, and government powers that be. So they're telling a story which supports their agenda and has been documented to be intended to create willing and docile employees and rabid consumers and effective managers of a system that is there to serve giant corporations and banks. So I encourage people as much as you can too to take responsibility for your own education and the education of your children and your neighbors, and really have discussions about what is education and how can we access it without just succumbing to a system where you come out $50,000 to $100,000 in debt and to a great extent indoctrinated into the system which is not working. Exactly. And in fact, I'll mention to for those who are interested, there are two universities already, just since we launched, who have asked to collaborate with us and are already giving college credit for studying the Thrive curriculum through the film and the website as it is now and as it develops. And that's Wisdom University and Gaia, G-A-I-A University. And we're being approached by more kind of free-thinking educational institutions who are wanting to take advantage of the kind of comprehensive research that we've done to give people access to information without telling them what to think.
That's brilliant. That's absolutely brilliant. Yeah, I think it's very important that the information gets out into all those fields. I also think it's very important for parents. Once you do sort of your eyes flutter and you do wake up, to transfer that information to your children, if they're willing, if they're as individuals willing to hear what you have to say, because you can't force. That's the old paradigm. The new paradigm is to work in partnership with your next generation and the next generation. Work in partnership with. It's not a control, do it because I say so thing. That's the old paradigm. And my children, I mean, we haven't had TV in this house in 16 years. My 15-year-old son and my 13-year-old son have never seen TV, not in this house. And we have a lot of books. We have books all over the place here. If they want to read about subjects, they can read. But in the educational systems, they know enough. Our children are aware enough to know that the vast majority of what they're hearing is programming. It's laced. It's laced, and my sons can see it. They're at that point now. They've been around me long enough that just through the process of being around us and the way we think and look at things, is they've picked up on that, and they can see the threads very easily. And yet they understand that if they're going to a medical, if they're learning about anything medical, a lot of the books are supplied by the pharmaceutical industries. They supply the books.
Yes, exactly.
If you're learning about other sort of economic systems, they're supplied by the people who are running the systems. You know, be it the Rothschilds who started the whole schooling system anyway, when they got involved with it and changed the curriculum. There's a test that we've seen on the internet of early 1900s, and it was a grade 6 test. And it looked like something from the fourth year of university.
Yes.
It was amazing. And that system has been dumbed down so much. It's not no child left behind. It's all children left behind.
Yeah.
Well, that's our system's come to, I think.
And along that line, I want to also encourage people, if you're not there already, really learn from the next generation coming up. Just because they haven't been on the planet as long as you have doesn't mean they haven't explored ways of thinking that you might not yet have considered. And by way of illustrating that, I want to acknowledge my own son, Trevor, who was my major teacher. He was the one who helped lift the blindfold for me in relation to both economics, following the money, and in terms of liberty. So when he graduated from college, he came to me and he said, you know, in order to figure out how to best leverage my energy, where to put my energy in the world, I need to figure out how this world really works. And to me, that means following the money. So I said, boy, you know, you have my blessings. Good luck. Let me know what you find. And he spent 6 intense years studying economics worldwide and getting behind the usual textbooks and really following what was going on. Sounds like a lot of the threads that you've also followed, Scott. And then he came to me and said, Dad, you know, before you put out this film, there's some things I think you really ought to know if you don't already. And so I immersed deeply and really learned from him and a lot of the resources that he opened me up to. And so it was a really fun experience for me and very satisfying for him as well to have his dad, who was pretty well-informed on a lot of subjects, really be learning from him on what he'd been exploring. And he's just recently, I'll plug his book because it's a quick and seminal read.
Go for it.
Just published a book that's on Amazon just in the last few weeks as a result of all this research called Nonviolent Prosperity, The Principles of Liberty. So check it out. His name is Trevor Gamble.
Okay.
It'll save you a lot of time.
Also, I'm going to get a link for that. If you can send me a link for that, I will put that on your upcoming guests. It'll be in the upcoming guests show tonight when this airs. And the next day, it'll be in our archives in our past guest show. Everybody
right.
knows that they can go to my site and you can listen to the full interview at any time. Of all of our interviews, full length and free to listen to on our website, www.spectrumradionetwork.com. Now that we're plugging websites, does your son have a website, and what's the website address of your son's?
He doesn't have a website at this point.
Okay.
So the best way to access him is to read the book, and then if you're interested, contact me, and I can tell you how to get in touch with him. You can contact me at info@thrivemovement.com.
Okay. Yeah, it would be interesting to hear what he has to say about it, as far as maybe I can get him as a guest on the show.
Yeah, his site is under construction now, but it's not ready yet.
Okay. You let me know when his site is ready, because
I'd be
honored to have an interview with him and talk about that, because I think what you said there is very, very important. I've said this myself to people. I said the younger generation aren't programmed yet. They're the ones who can tell you the new ways of looking at things. If you get them young enough, they're wide open. They
yeah.
don't have the layers of manipulation and control built up like a scale that you would get on, build up on your teeth. They don't have all that stuff built up on them yet.
Yes.
Pay attention to what they're saying, because they're more aware of what's going on than you possibly are. I think that's important. I really think that. And the other thing I think is important is what a friend of mine, Wade Frazier, says is a council of grandmothers.
Yes.
If you want to, the wisdom of the Council of Grandmothers, you see what we have now is a system mostly male-dominated, you know, having control over things, wanting to put things down, take as much as you want. The male principle, you know, is very dominant. But with a Council of Grandmothers, you have that, you know, that wisdom and the feminine energy of let's work out the problem. Come on, I've been, you know, the women have been dealing with sons fighting for, you know, generations. They have
yeah,
to break up the fight.
Yeah, let me chime in on that for a moment, too, because with all my study of energy and physics and so forth, still the most powerful force I've come across in the universe is female humans. And the feminine energy has played such a huge role in the whole Thrive movement, particularly as embodied by my wife Kimberly, but with all of the women on our team, and the feminine aspect in myself and the other men on the team that we're all working on developing. Because just as free energy is accessed only through harmonic resonance, through accessing nonviolently the flow of energy itself rather than trying to crash it together and control the explosion in the old kind of male macho way of doing it. In the same way, the kind of communications for conflict resolution and for sharing critical information is now starting to happen with a feminine energy that really hasn't been present much before. And we're getting responses from all over the planet thanking us for the gentleness with which Thrive conveys very challenging information. And I owe a real nod of acknowledgement to Kimberly for that, because she is not only my beloved partner, but was my director on the set. And she knew from day one that what she kept saying was most of the information, particularly on conspiracy, has been conveyed by angry, ranting men. And it's turned off so many people, and especially turned off women. That the key to the Aikido of getting this information across is to deliver it from your confidence about the way out and allow space in the communication for the viewer to have their own emotional response rather than having yours crammed down their throat. And it took me a while to really find in myself the place that she was talking about. And the first time that I did on the set, When she finally said, that's it, you know, that's what I was looking for, I came off the set and I looked around, about half the staff was in tears. And I realized something just happened here. And it really helped me to find a softer place within myself, because I can get pretty wound up around what's being done to billions of people's lives.
Yeah.
And, you know, I go into warrior mode and I can get very fierce about this. There's a time for that when it's needed, but it can still be channeled nonviolently. And when we're communicating the information that's challenging for people to hear, is not the time to flood the space with our own intensity about it. So women are responding. Teenage girls, through women of all ages, are really responding positively, saying, thank you. This gives me the information, it gives me the hope, and I am getting active. And one thing I've learned in a lifetime of activism is when the women and mothers take on a task, it's done. When they're protecting their families, nothing is going to ultimately stand in their way.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that completely. And you nailed it. If your wife was helping in that capacity, boy, she did the job, because it does come through the Thrive movie. You can see that sensitivity there. Yes, I'm giving you this information. Yes, this information can piss you off, but there are solutions. Yeah, it's very interesting you mentioned that you can definitely see it. I was going to ask about Kimberly and her contribution in the film. What was her way of thinking and her way of approaching things that influenced, beyond the being the producer or the director, what was her influence on you as a person?
Well, it's my favorite topic, and I could easily go on for the next 2 days talking about it, because I have such respect for her. People are responding so positively to her segments in the film, because she did her own homework. She's not someone who just believes me or anyone else categorically. So she did her own homework and realized that the information we were conveying was true, and then some. There's a whole lot we didn't have time to go into. But she's very good at staying in touch with her own emotional process and having compassion and encouraging compassion in others, for that everyone is going to respond differently and at different times to this information. So some people will be just gung-ho, okay, I get it, let's go do something about it. And others are going to feel like they're sick, and others are going to be depressed for a while, and others are just going to need people to talk to and to work this through. So if we each can honor one another's path with this and then act in a way that's true to our own inner guidance, I would say we would be getting Kimberly's message as successfully as possible.
Wow, that's great. Okay, the movie was Thrive movie. You can get it at the website, Foster, if you want to give your website and any contact information. That would be great.
We're at thrivemovement.com. You can explore the website, you can rent the movie, or you can buy the DVD there, and there are plenty of comment boards and blogs where you can participate. This is a global interactive process that we're looking to share.
That's great. And as soon as you do come up with tour dates and tour areas, I'm sure that'll be posted on Thrive. But if you do come up, send me a list and I'll put it up in the news section of the website.
Well, I really appreciate that. And it's an honor to get to be on your show, Scott. I really admire the work that you've been doing, and it's been a delight to be part of this conversation.
Well, thank you, Foster. And we'll see you guys next week. Bye-bye.